by C.S. Lewis, and this is a series of letters written from one demon to another, giving advice on how to capture our soul. So what's been going on in the life of our patient here the past several weeks? What's been the situation? He's fallen in love with a Christian. It's terrible. This strong young Christian lady has been causing him to have some bad habits, like starting to pray and spend time with happy Christian people. And so in this letter, Screwtape knows that Wormwood's on the ropes here. He knows things are looking grim. So he's going to talk about how to pull him back here from the edge, where the patient's gotten to. The patient's in danger of being firmly in the Lord's service here. And Screwtape certainly doesn't want that to happen. So we'll talk about what's happening here, specifically about perseverance today. Somebody could start off and read the first paragraph and introduce our topic. And when he talks about the war, bear in mind this was written in 1941. This is World War II that he's talking about.
My dear Wormwood, when I told you not to fill your letters with rubbish about the war, I meant, of course, that I did not want to have your rather infantile rhapsodies about the death of men and the destruction of cities. Insofar as the war really concerns the spiritual state of the patient, I naturally want full report. And on this aspect, you seem singularly obtuse. Thus you tell me with glee that there is reason to expect heavy air raids on the town where the creature lives. This is a crying example of something I have complained about already. Your readiness to forget the main point and your immediate enjoyment of human suffering. Do you know that the bums kill men? Or do you realize that the patient's death at this moment is precisely what we want to avoid? He has escaped the world of friends with whom you tried to entangle him. He has fallen in love with a very Christian woman and is temporarily immune from the attacks on his chastity and the various methods of corrupting his spiritual life, which we have been trying are so far unsuccessful. At the present moment, as the full impact of the war draws nearer, and his worldly hopes take a proportionally lower place in his mind, full of his defense work, full of the girl, forced to attend to his neighbors more than he has ever done before, and liking it more than he expected, taking out of himself, as the humans say, and daily increasing in conscious dependence on the enemy. He will almost certainly be lost to us if he is killed tonight. This is so obvious that I'm ashamed to write it. I sometimes wonder if you young friends are not kept out of temptation duty too long at a time. If you are not in some danger of becoming infected by the sentiments and values of the humans among whom you work.
Okay, so he's talking about the war. Wormwood is talking gleefully about the war and the destruction and people getting killed. What is he overlooking in this situation? What is it that Screwtape reminds him of about people getting killed?
Or if he would get killed that night, they would definitely lose him. He was at the point where it was getting desperate for them to win him over to their side.
Okay. He says, you tend to forget, but the idea isn't about whether or not somebody lives or dies, it's the condition of their soul at the time whenever it does happen. You think that sometimes we fall into that trap of being overly concerned about people's physical well-being rather than their spiritual well-being.
Okay.
you look at our prayer list, what types of things land people on our prayer list? What's that?
Illness.
You're an expert on that, Suzanne. You're the one that puts them on there. It's mostly physical problems, as I recall. You know, and it's not to say that these aren't serious and shouldn't be prayed about, because they are serious. There are people that have cancer on there. There are people that have had bad accidents. There are people with serious illnesses on there. And they should be on our prayer list. What you don't see on our prayer list a lot are spiritual problems. And these are the most pressing concerns that we should have. We often pray about people's physical well-being, about how, you know, how sick somebody is, how they're struggling through surgeries and struggling with chemotherapy and all these things. But sometimes we forget about people's spiritual well-being. When we have a coworker, a friend, or a relative, you know, we often approach God about their physical well-being. What's the spiritual state of your coworker, of your friend, of your family member? I've got some family members that are not active Christians, but I tend to pray more about them whenever they're sick or injured than I do about their spiritual condition on a day-to-day basis. And that shouldn't be, because even the demons recognize that our physical well-being is of actual minimal importance compared to our spiritual well-being. From the demon's point of view, and it should be from our point of view, what real difference, when it comes right down to it, does it make if I live or die? What really matters is what's my spiritual condition whenever I die. That's what the demons know that is the most important thing we should be concerned about. Yes.
And then if you mentioned it, I think most of us would be probably guilty of being a friend. That's not the deal. A friend, not for the spiritual aspect of the individual. And I find myself in that. I do have a person to say that I've known the good praise for the physical well-being of the individual.
What good does it do for God to heal a person's body if their soul is still lost? All that, it may buy them a little more time, but ultimately, they still need to be concerned about the soul, about the condition. You'd think if a demon could recognize that, that perhaps we should be able to. But so often we forget. Okay, so at first when Wormwood was writing back in some of the early letters, he talked about the war in very gleeful terms. What were some of Screwtape's concerns about people living during wartime?
That they get more spiritual.
Okay, sometimes war tends to make people more spiritual rather than less spiritual. What's going on with the patient here in this first paragraph? How's he spending his time?
Care
for
the neighbors.
Okay.
And actually liking
them. And actually liking
them. And I think that's really what gets them in there. You know, he actually loves to do that.
Discovers that, you know, it's not so bad to have an external focus rather than an internal focus. You know, that's whenever most people are happiest, is whenever they're so busy helping out with other things larger than themselves, with helping out friends and neighbors and with things at church, and you're so busy you forget about your own problems. That's when it seems like most people are the happiest and the strongest spiritually, is whenever they forget about themselves and they're so concerned about other people's well-being. Not about being a busybody, being concerned with other people, but about actually being concerned with other people's well-being, not just all of the stuff that you can gossip about going on in their life. Okay. Talk to Thomas.
I really think this part about, you know, having joy in helping others, it's really a God-given gift. And I think a lot of people don't plug into that. And don't discover how much joy or satisfaction it can give you as the giver until you actually do it. And that reminded me of this here, you know. Because like you said, you forget about your own problems. And I heard many people say, I would rather give than take. And I think we don't plug into this sometimes enough.
Somehow, after you've been helping somebody who is so desperate for help, when you do finally get back to your own problems, suddenly they seem a lot less significant. When you realize, you know, that your problems, whether they're financial or physical, pale in comparison to a lot of other people's problems that you may help out with. You may think, you know, I don't really have a whole lot of money to spend, but then when you get involved with helping somebody who is actually destitute, then you come back and you count your blessings as far as all the things that you do have and that you enjoy. And suddenly that thing you wanted to buy that you couldn't afford seems a lot less significant than it did before. Any other comments before we move on? All right, if somebody will read paragraph number one.
They, of course, do tend to regard death as the prime evil and survival as the greatest good, but that is because we have taught them to do so. Do not let us be infected by our own propaganda. I know it seems strange that your chief aim at the moment should be the very same thing for which the patient's lover and his mother are praying, namely his bodily safety. But so it is. You should be guarding him like the apple of your eye. If he dies now, you lose him. If he survives the war, there is always hope. The enemy has guarded him from you through the first great wave of temptations, but only if he can be kept alive, you have time yourself for your ally. The long, dull, monotonous years of middle-aged prosperity and middle-aged adversity are excellent campaigning weather. You see, it is so hard for these creatures to persevere. The routine of adversity, the gradual decay of youthful loves and youthful hopes, the quiet despair, hardly causes pain, of ever overcoming the chronic temptations with which we have again and again defeated them, the gravness which we create in their lives, and the inarticulate resentment with which we teach them to respond to it. All this provides admirable opportunities of wearing out a soul by attrition. If, on the other hand, the middle years prove prosperous, our position is even stronger. Prosperity dips a man to the world. He feels that he is, quote, finding his place in it, end quote, while really it is finding its place in him. His increasing reputation, his widening circle of acquaintances, his sense of importance, the growing pressure of absorbing and agreeable work, build up in him a sense of being really at home in earth, which is just what we want. You will notice that the young are generally less unwilling to die than the middle-aged and the old.
Okay. So he's talking about the middle portion of the years. Which is, I'm not going to use the term middle age because that has negative connotation. But most of us in this room, we've made it through the young and reckless years and all that, and we've settled out into a pattern into our lives. And for some people, that's a pattern of prosperity now, in what's commonly referred to as your prime earning years. Or for some people, as he says, it's a middle age of adversity, where you've had problems in your life and now you're struggling. And he says, you know, it really doesn't matter which it is. He says, as demons, we can still work on that. So what's the contrast there? If you live a life of adversity during your middle-aged years, how does Satan work on you with that?
Satan.
Okay. And what he's really talked about here is discouragement. You feel like, okay, I'm in that part of my life when it should be the prime of my life. I've settled into a job. At this time maybe I've bought a house. I've got cars or something. Why is everything such a struggle? We're taking the middle age of adversity right now. Why? And also, I'm a Christian. Why is God not helping me more? Why am I not living a life of luxury now? I've had, maybe 10, 20, 30, 40 working years to build up and accumulate stuff, and yet I have nothing at this point. And so Satan works on that discouragement that you feel. What's the Christian response to this feeling of desperation or discouragement during a middle-age period of adversity? Okay. It's very easy for us to do because we're surrounded by it constantly. This idea of consumption, this idea of wealth, of materialism. It seems like the media is constantly telling us we want stuff. Until after a while we begin to believe it, that we do want stuff all the time. And it's even more frustrating when it's stuff you can't afford. When it's being thrown in your face, you should have this, you should have this. That last year's car is last year's car. You should have this year's car. You should want this year's car. You deserve this. And that's an increasing problem in our society, is this feeling of entitlement. Because I'm now 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, I deserve to have this. God would want me to have this, and I deserve to have this. It doesn't matter whether it's a car or a smartphone or the latest electronic gadget or the newer house or whatever it is. We get this feeling sometimes we deserve to have this. And so then it's very frustrating when we don't, or when we can't afford it, or we have it and we can't afford it. That's bad too. When we decided we deserved it, and so we got it anyway, and now we realize why we didn't have it before, because we can't afford it. But God wants you to be prosperous. And so if you're not prosperous, you just don't have enough faith. And that's a discouraging message to people that have been trying to live by faith. And now they're being told, because you don't have, you just don't have enough faith. And so that's very difficult. But then let's take the flip side. Many, even people in this room, are in a middle age of relative prosperity. Even if you don't feel like you're that prosperous, if you actually look around at how many people live, and especially if people in some other countries live, you're actually living, a lot of us, in a middle age of prosperity. If we have jobs and we have things and we have a house and we have cars that we're making payments on, that's relative prosperity. So how does Satan work on you if you're having a prosperous middle age? Okay. For one thing, you never have enough, right? There's always a more expensive car, a better house that maybe your friend or your neighbor has that you look at and you think, well, their house is better than my house. Okay? How else does Satan work on you?
It's hard to measure pride. It's the opposite. The solution that you found your place in the world, but really the world found its place in you.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy, when you're prosperous. I think a lot of times, people are afraid to die because they're having too good a time. Okay, people love this world too much. They want to leave it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that that's a uniquely American problem. I think it's probably a uniquely wealth problem. And compared to most of the world, we're screaming at wealth. For all the bribing that we do.
Signal. world, this song, this world's not my home, but then we're thinking in the back of our mind, we're being a little disingenuous. We're thinking, yeah, this is my home. I'm enjoying it here. I'm enjoying life. Okay, Ray and Rick. Yeah, that's true.
So I didn't care too much for that. No, I didn't care anything for that. I'll be honest with that. They allow me to think of the time.
I know, and I understand the sentiment. You've got a lot going on in your life to live for, but maybe that is a sign that you're getting a little too settled in and entrenched in this world.
Yeah.
To be fair, maybe she wasn't a Christian with more to look forward to after this life. Yeah, Rich.
I was just backing up her dream. There's a real popular country western song now. Everybody wants to go to heaven. Everybody wants to go to heaven.
Was there anything wrong with not wanting to go right now?
I think a lot of that depends on why you don't want to go right now.
Okay, that's the point. I mean, it's real easy to sit here and say.
Right. I mean, if you've still got people to reach and God's work to do, you know, Paul said, I'm torn. He said, you know, there's still things I can be doing here, but, you know, I'm just as happy going ahead and meeting my Maker. But if we don't want to go right now just because I'm having too good a time, you know, I'm enjoying life and all the things that life has to offer, and I'm not really spending that much time doing God's work, I'm just doing what I want to do. Yeah, I had a feeling it wasn't because there's more of the Lord's work to do. It's just because you're happy here, because this world is your home, and you're very happy here.
I mean, otherwise, why would you go have an operation in India? Why would you take your medicine? Or, you know, if somebody's on a leg, would you say, oh, well, no, you got a better thing waiting for you, just go ahead and jump off? I mean,
But Screwtape says, and of course these are C.S. Lewis's words, not the Bible's words, but he says, you know, Satan's the one that invented this idea of wanting to hang on to life for every minute possible, and that somebody dying is the worst possible thing in the world. You know, Screwtape says, hey, we invented that philosophy. So what's wrong with that philosophy?
Not true. You know, we were created first and foremost eternal beings, and we forget that. But I'm firmly convinced that the Garden of Eden was intended to go on to eternity. I mean, that's just my own personal, you know, belief in the first chapter of Genesis. And it was sin. Brought that to an end. And we forget that. You know, we think that, okay, we've got our 70 or 80 or in some cases 14 or 15 years to live. And after that, you know, we really don't know. You know, we talk a lot about heaven and think about it. We have sometimes a hard time wrapping our heads around it. But I think we do very lose sight of the fact that we are first and foremost eternal beings. And we can't. There's no third option. You know, I mean, there are other options. You're going to spend eternity somewhere. Okay? And how many people do you know that feel like, yeah, that's not true? And after you die, well, okay.
So what's the spiritual viewpoint of life? Either from a demon or from a Christian point of view, what's life all about? You know, people struggle with what's the meaning of life. But what is the meaning of life? To what end? What's our goal here on fearing God and obeying His commands and, you know, living life as Christians?
Sure, we can spend eternity where God is.
Okay. We need to remember the goal there is The goal is the destination. And whether we take the long route or the short route to get there really isn't important. That's what God wants us to understand, and that's what we struggle with so much, is the idea that you know, life must be protected at all costs. Exactly. If you barely tolerate being a Christian right now, and it's just a fire escape for you, then if a simple question is, you know, are you looking forward to heaven, or are you kind of dreading that idea of, okay, I got to spend eternity with all these people? You know, maybe that's cause for concern and some introspection. Yes. Military, I took a lot of pass-fail tests, and the feeling was always if you made more than a 70, the minimum passing grade, you studied too hard, because it's pass-fail. You don't get anything more for making a 100 than you did getting a 70. And if that's the way we look at our Christian lives, well, this is pass-fail, which in essence it is, but if we're looking, okay, what's the bare minimum I can do to manage to sneak into heaven, but I still want to keep this other foot in the world and enjoy everything I can in the world, you know, not just because, you know, it's God's creation and you know, He created it and it was very good, but because we want to do as much as we can that doesn't agree with our Christian life and still somehow manage to scrape by and have God say, all right, you just barely made it. You'd gotten drunk one more time, you wouldn't have made it. Or you know, whatever it is that is our weakness in life. You know, that's how some people look at it. And especially whenever you hear people say, well, you know, becoming a Christian and making it to heaven, that's the kind of thing I'll do whenever I'm 80. You know, right now I'm having too much fun. You know, I'll think about spiritual things later.
You know, the aspect is God didn't say, I want 80% of you. He says, I want 100%. And this is exactly how we need to live our lives. I mean, yes, we're going to fail. We're going to have these weak moments. And this is not really what he's talking about. What are you going to do after you realize you have that weak moment? That's going to be the deciding factor. You can't go out and do as you please for 20% of your life or your day or whatever, and then think God's going to be satisfied with the other 80. It's not going to work.
Thoughts are coming. Oh, somebody can read the next paragraph.
Thank you.
A lot in this chapter. Okay. He first says that that God has guarded us pretty effectively from the danger of feeling at home anywhere else. So, what do you think he means by that? And do you think it's true? Has God made this world so that we feel at home in it? Right. Then on the other hand, this is all we know. This seems like home to us because this is where we've been all of our lives. And we talk about heaven and we think about heaven, but we don't really see it. And so it's this place that we talk about, but it's hard for us to visualize what it's like. You have the two extremes. You have the people that say, you know, I'm very comfortable in this life. And he talks about turning this world into heaven. That you always have this vision that 10 or 20 years from now, this world's going to somehow be heaven because we're going to have solved the problems in the world and the world is going to be a fantastic place to be 10 or 20 years from now. We read science fiction stories and everything is fantastic in those a lot of times because all the problems have been solved, and so there's no problems with, you know, having enough energy and fighting and wars and bigotry and racism, and you know, all those problems have been solved. On Star Trek, everybody gets along fine, no matter what their background. So therefore we know that eventually this earth is going to be a nice place and it feels very much like home. But then, as you said, we also have the other extreme where we start feeling like, okay, our life is kind of settled in, and we feel good about our life, and you know, we feel like, all right, we've got everything together, and we've got control of our finances, and we live where we want, and we like our neighborhood, and we like our family, and we like our kids and our dogs and all these things. And so, but then we start thinking, okay, I get up, I go to work, you know, I come home, I eat, I sleep. And you start getting into this idea of, well, shouldn't there be more to life than this? You get into the cycle of doing the same things over and over. We call it getting in a rut a lot of times. And for some people, that is all their life consists of. And they picture themselves, okay, I'm going to live out my life, and I'm going to die, and nobody's ever even going to know I was here. And that starts to be a little scary to some people, that, you know, I'm not going to leave a mark on the world. Okay? What's the Christian response to that idea?
Well, I think it's got a lot to do with where's your focus in your life. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's on the world, then you go through all of these things you just mentioned. But if your focus is on Christ, I don't know, at least in my life, the older I get, the more I look forward to one day spending time with Him. This is, living in this world, you have struggles. I don't care where you at, whether you're rich or poor, there are struggles that you go through in every stage of your life. But to me, I look forward to one day being with Christ because I don't want these struggles anymore. And I want to reach a point where I don't have to face all of these things. So I think it has to do with where your focus is in life, mm-hmm. on how you look at all of this. You know, if I'm on the world, and yes, you know, if I die, nothing's going to be left behind that reminds anybody of me. But if your focus is on Christ, my point is, who cares who remembers what I did or what I didn't do in this world? You know, I want Christ to remember what I did,
right.
Not the people of the world.
I think the problem is what we define as making our mark
Yeah,
not exactly. You may never be as touchy as a local teacher. Okay. You may, or, you know, you may not be a household name or something like that. It kind of reminds me of when I was at this leadership story, we had to read about a great leader, and this guy came in, and it didn't have to be a good, it could be a bad person, but mm-hmm. great in the sense that they did a lot. And his was really a prime, and he was all caught up in the idea of how many soldiers this guy had, and, you know, look at Alexander the Great. And I said, okay, well, that Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks got on a bus. She was tired. She had worked all day. So she sat down on the seat. I mean, you didn't tell me that's not a leader. She started a revolution, basically. And I think about your grandmother. She allowed them to have a tent meeting in her front yard, and she became a Christian and had how many kids and grandkids and spread that. And I was thinking about, you know, you were talking about the commercial on TV. There's a commercial from Ancestry.com, and this woman said that my great-great-grandmother, who it was, had this many kids and only one of them survived. So that one child is the reason why all these other people are here. And so I think that we tend to think of leaving our mark on life as doing something that everybody knows something about. And we don't know that, because the same thing whenever you speak to someone about Christ, you don't know that if they ever become a Christian or not, but they might. For all you know, they may touch more people and may touch more people. So I think the problem is we tend to think of leaving our mark on life as becoming a household name in some sense.
And out of the 100 billion people that have lived so far, there's a very tiny percentage that we still remember their names because they did something important. But as a Christian, you have the opportunity to do something that has eternal significance. And you have the opportunity to leave a legacy behind in the people whose souls are saved because you lived your life.
Yes, sir. I think the most important thing to all of this is being remembered, even being remembered the type of individual it was. The reason I still do talk about Michael Jones so much is because of the category that he left a legacy behind, because of his acting, because of the type of person he was. I like to remember people like Homer Smiley, and his brother still living in his 90s, man, John Smiley, still preaching. These people, some of them, I just won't forget. Charles Duffel. I just can't forget these individuals because of the mark they left on me. I would certainly hope that I would leave a mark on somebody in this world. After I'm gone, remember what I did and what I did do, what I tried to do, the type of life I tried to lead. I want that to mean something to me. Not all of this other stuff to be from Oprah. But it means so much when you can speak with another Christian. Now, there are men in this room that have left a mark on me. And they're right in the room. And Russ, and yourself, and Jerry, and every brother in me has left something that I can remember about them, which means something to them. I don't mean I say nothing to them about it. Mm-hmm. That doesn't matter. God knows how I feel about that. That means a great deal to me. When I say, brother, a great teacher, a fine teacher, and no nonsense guy. I like to say that about an individual that I feel that way about. I love that. The sisters here who are conducting themselves in a way that they should, they first uphold God, and then, of course, their husband, they respect their husband to follow their lead. No matter, I think I'm brother Michael for example, you remind me usually. Now, his wife's a little out of trouble. Well, she loves that man, and she won't accept him. I know that. He may not say a lot, but when he says something, it's worth saying. And these are the kind of things that I observe about people. So don't think they're sitting in a chair, and ain't all that. It's all that. It's all that. And I respect this kind of people for that. And I expect the men and the women for the role that they play. Mm-hmm. It means something to me. Sorry, I didn't say all that.
But just imagine getting to heaven and having Jesus say, see this group of people right here? These are the people that are here because you live. There's no better memorial to you than that. Yeah.
Well, I think you know, the idea of being able to look at the world and going, this is all there is. I think that is, can and should be, a very healthy spiritual way to look at the world. Think about it. Mm-hmm. Because that's what will allow us to keep from being absorbed into the world when we look at it and realize that, yeah, you know, that's really all there is to the world. Why do I want to stay here?
Right.
And what do I want to invest myself in worldly things for when I realize it's really all there is? Mm-hmm. And that can help me keep my focus on the spiritual things so that I can reach out to other people and do the things that will help people to reach the Lord and make a difference in people's lives, knowing that this is all there really is here. So mm-hmm. I don't want to be here forever.
And so many times we think, you know, if only my financial situation were this way, I'd be happy. But we look at people that are rich, and you know, there's no higher percentage of happiness with rich people than there are with poor people. And that's what God wants us to see, is if we do get to that point where we're prosperous and we look and say, is this all there is? God wants us to say, no, that's not all there is. And here, let me show you what there is in life, because this isn't it. This materialism or the things that you have, this isn't what makes your life. It's not what makes your life important. That has nothing to do with it. You know, God doesn't care if you're rich or if you're poor. And we shouldn't care in that sense, in the spiritual sense, whether we're rich or we're poor. It's not what we have, it's what we do with it. What do we make of our life, the important aspects of our life? Because it doesn't really matter how much money we make. What matters is how do we spend our time? What do we do while we're here? Where do we place our faith? And what effect does that have on our life? Faith is an active word. It's not saying, yes, Jesus, I believe you existed 2,000 years ago. It's saying, I understand that you still exist right now, and that you're a part of my life, and you affect everything I do and every decision that I make. Everything that happens, I'm taking God into consideration. Yeah. All right. Our time's about up. The last paragraph just continues the same thought that before. It doesn't really add a lot to the discussion, so we'll skip that and I'll let you read it on your own and come up with those things. But we need to remember that perseverance is what he was talking about, of you know, lasting those however many years we have, but persevering. Whether we're going through adversity or whether we're going through prosperity, either one can drag us down and either one can drag us away from God. That's what Satan is counting on, is to use those years that you've been given to pull you away from God. And God's trying to get you to use those years to pull back toward Him. Closing thoughts or comments?
I think prosperity is, it's more than just how much stuff I have, it's what's important. I was thinking about the people in Somalia, and they asked this lady to draw their children to walk for 40 days, left her farm and everything she owned, because they had nothing to eat. And she said, I'm so happy that we're here. And it wasn't because she had more, it's because she had what was important. Maybe it's between this life and then the other life.
Attitude there. Mm-hmm. All right. Rick, could you close us in prayer?
Dear Heavenly Father, we're thankful that we've had this hour that we could gather together and look into your priesthood concept and knowledge that you wish to depart. thankful that we're aware that there is warfare going on in the spiritual nature. That we're in constant